MacCast, Sunday, September 18th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. What a strange week it has been. You know, I never put much stake in rumors, but every once in a while, you hope that they actually turn out to be true. And all this week, I was waiting and waiting, wondering if Apple would send out an announcement for its special event. It was kind of predicted by most of the rumor sites that that would happen. Turns out, it never really did. But certainly was no shortage of news or rumors. We're going to dive into all of that stuff here in a moment. But before we get started, I want to take a quick moment, thank one of my show's sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, this is an awesome application because it allows you to not only take notes, but to add additional content and information to that to help you get organized. So it has voice support. You can throw in voice annotations, tabs and flags. You can add on sticky notes, do highlighting, and all of that stuff goes to help organize your stuff, especially different tab dividers and sections. So it really works like a physical notebook. It's not just a text application. There's lots of layers and stuff that you can put on top of it. And then add to that the fact that as you're working, it creates this thing called the multi-dex, which means that it's indexing all kinds of information in the background automatically and building out a little index in the back of your notebook, and you can go there to the different sections and find stuff really quickly and easily. So it indexes words, URLs, numbers, to-dos. So if you're working on a to-do list and you have stuff, you can find all that stuff, and it doesn't matter what page it's on, which section it's in, you can go to the index and look that up right away. And they continue to update the program. They enhance it. They add more performance. They were right there when Lion was launched, so a lot of developers kind of drug their feet. Circus Ponies is always up there updating their stuff, getting it ready to go. And it was actually updated before Lion was even released. So great program, great application, great developer. Check it out, circusponies.com. They have free trials available. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So while we didn't get an update on Apple's special event, which should be coming up here in a few weeks, I would imagine. Who knows if the invites didn't go out. Apple did push out a couple of updates, actually quite a few updates for its most recent Macs. EFI firmware updates for the MacBook Air, firmware update 2.1. That was for the mid-2011 models. It includes fixes that enhance the stability of the Lion recovery from an internet connection and resolves issues with Apple's Thunderbolt display compatibility, and it adds Thunderbolt target disk mode performance updates. Also, MacBook Pro EFI firmware update 2.2 for the MacBook Pro early 2011 models. This actually enables Lion recovery from an internet connection, so that brings that same functionality that the latest MacBook Airs and Mac Minis has to the latest edition of the MacBook Pro. So if you have one of those, you probably want to grab this. Also includes a fix that resolves issues with Apple's Thunderbolt display compatibility and Thunderbolt target disk mode performance. And then the Mac Mini EFI firmware update 1.3 for the Mac Mini 2001 mid-2011 models includes a fix that enhances stability for Lion recovery from an internet connection, resolves issues with Apple's Thunderbolt display compatibility, and has the Thunderbolt target disk mode performance update. So all those kind of are very similar, with the exception of the MacBook Pro EFI firmware update bringing that internet recovery feature for Lion to those models. Now, one model that didn't get an update is the latest edition of iMacs. And according to Cult of Mac, they've reported that some iMac users are having strange graphics and video issues under Lion. One of the screenshots on the Cult of Mac post showed the icons in the tab switching panel being scrambled. And it's really interesting because that it's like only the images inside the icons are the area that's being scrambled. It's not like your whole display is scrambled. So these weird graphic anomalies. And luckily, restarting seems to resolve the issue, but unfortunately, it only lasts temporarily. All the graphics issues, I guess, creep back in after some time. So Culta Mac has been kind of looking into it, and they confirmed with an Apple engineer that Apple is aware of the bug in Lion, and it does seem to be a software issue, not a hardware issue. So that's good news. It means there's not actually something wrong with the chip, and hopefully they'll be able to fix that with a software update. There were also some reports in the comments saying that there might be some other models that are affected. So if you've been affected, shoot me an email. I'm curious how far it extends and which models it extends into. But definitely the latest edition iMacs running Lion seem to have the bug. Apple didn't have a timeline for when they were actually going to do the fix, but hopefully it'll be resolved soon, maybe even in the next update to Lion 10.7.2, which I think has been out there and has been being tested by developers. Electronista had a rumor this week saying that Apple may be getting ready to bump the MacBook Pro models mid-season. Even though the machines were released in February of this year, they think that they might get a speed bump this month. The reason they're citing is to stay competitive with the newer PC laptops that were recently released, and because Intel has bumped the Ivy Bridge processor release back to March or later of 2012. So that would mean if Apple waited like they typically do for the next generation of processors to be released, the MacBook Pros would have to go over a year without an update. Now, Apple has done mid-season bumps before in its history, so it certainly wouldn't be unprecedented. I would assume it would be a quiet update, probably just to rev the CPUs. In terms of what Electronista thinks they might use, they're saying the 13-inch MacBook Pro models could jump from the dual-core 2.3 gigahertz Core i5 and 2.7 gigahertz Core i7 processors up to 2.5 gigahertz and 2.8 gigahertz. And then on the 15-inch and 17-inch MacBook Pros, those would jump from 2 gigahertz, 2.2 gigahertz, and 2.3 gigahertz, the quad-core i7s they have now, up to 2.4 gigahertz, 2.5 gigahertz, and 2.7 gigahertz, respectively. So it certainly wouldn't hurt to do that. It could juice some of the sagging back-to-school sales numbers that we'd been hearing, and would help bump Apple's fiscal first quarter 2012 numbers up here in the end of the year. Apple's sales for the current quarter, though, are going strong. Gene Munster noted in his latest NPD numbers that Mac sales may be up 22% so far this quarter. He expects Macs to sell 4.4 to 4.8 6 million units in the quarter, and he's attributing that to strong sales of Lion, the new MacBook Airs, and the new Mac Mini. Interestingly, he does expect the typical slowing in the September quarter, meaning that a final quarterly result year-over-year gain would be about 13 to 18%. So strong at 22% so far beginning in the quarter, but by the end of the quarter, maybe dropping down to as low as 13%. And as far as what percentage of Mac's sales will make up those numbers, they're predicting about 20% of Apple's revenue for the quarter will come from the Mac. And what about after the Intel Ivy Bridge? What could be the next generation processor that Apple is working with? Well, at the Intel Developer Forum, Intel disclosed details on the next generation chips, codenamed Haswell. They will also use a 22 nanometer design like the Ivy Bridge, but offer a 30% reduction in active power use over a modern Core i5 processor. So Intel continuing to focus on really driving down power consumption on their chips while keeping performance up. Intel claims that could result in notebooks that run 24 hours on a charge. So we actually finally might actually get the 8 hours we're promised on the current generation chips. I guess that's what that translates to when you move from marketing speak to real world application. But, you know, you're going to see a nice bump in the power consumption on the Haswell chips, I think. And we've already seen them really pushing performance with the Ivy Bridge. And I get pretty good results out of my laptop, a good 5 to 7 hours, depending upon my usage. So I think moving forward, though, we're going to see chip manufacturers really focusing on the power thing, because as notebooks and things get slimmer and lighter, there's just less space for batteries. So the processors are going to have to take up some of the slack in increasing battery life by using literally less power. And consumers are kind of getting used to the battery life they get on their smartphones and tablets, which, you know, you look at something like the iPad, it goes for days or weeks on charges. And consumers are going to start to demand that kind of battery life out of their laptops. So that's what's happening with the kind of the next generation chips from Intel. Apple could be getting set to bump the Airport Express hardware sometime soon, at least according to a report over on Apple Insider. They note that some authorized resellers were showing the current 802.11n Airport Express hardware as discontinued in their systems. They also said they saw longer shipping lead times at resellers like Amazon, which historically has been an indication that Apple is getting ready to bump hardware. The rumor was further backed up by a source that claimed the Airport Utility 5.6 update currently in development references that it adds support for the Airport Express 802.11n second generation base station. It's likely that the update will be done quietly, just like it was to the Time Capsule and Airport Extreme back in June, and it's expected that the Express will get the same improved range and performance that those models did back then. This might not come as a shock to Apple fans, but the iPad 2 still dominates the tablet market. This is despite the rise of Android tablets, at least according to IDC. Apple gained market share in the second quarter over other tablet manufacturers. The tablet market saw an overall second quarter growth of 88.9% over the prior quarter and a year-over-year increase of 303.8%, selling a total of 13.6 million units. Apple's share for the quarter rose 65.7% over the prior quarter, in which it was 68.3%. By contrast, Android's market share fell from 34% to 26.8%, so significant drop. I think tablet fragmentation in the Android market certainly isn't helping their numbers. And the negative press isn't helping Apple's competitors either. I think in general that the public sees the iPad and quote-unquote other tablets. They don't make the distinction between a particular manufacturer. So Android likely suffers when we hear stories that are negative from RIM, HP, and Samsung. Specifically with the lawsuit news from Samsung, them being blocked from sales in certain markets for copying Apple, HP completely dropping out of the tablet space, and then the latest thing this week, RIM having some really low numbers in terms of playbook shipments. As a matter of fact, Apple shipped 9.25 million iPads last quarter versus RIM shipping about 490,000 playbooks. These numbers are from Bloomberg, and when they crunched them, that shows that for every 19 iPads that were sold, RIM just sold one playbook. So that definitely isn't helping in the eyes of consumers and certainly doesn't help bolster Android's numbers. Now, I do have to point out that there could be a little playful accounting going on with these numbers or processing of these numbers because, again, overall, tablet sales are up. So even though Android is down in terms of share a little bit quarter to quarter, it doesn't mean that they aren't selling a whole lot of Android tablets. And by the same token, it doesn't mean that Apple isn't selling a whole metric crud load of iPads. And according to Brazil's Minister of Science and Technology and Innovation, we're going to have a lot more iPads hitting the market soon coming out of their new factory. They said they could be shipping iPads out of the new Foxconn plant in Brazil by December. This will help reduce the iPad price in Brazil by up to 40% because they actually have really heavy import tariffs. So now that they can produce iPads in the country, they'll be able to sell them at a much lower cost, which is going to bring, I would imagine, sales in Brazil up quite significantly. So that's good news for Apple. That's also good news for the iPad supply. And all those people who have been wondering about the iPad 3, well, certainly iPad 2 demand is still up, and that would, I think, indicate that there's no reason for Apple to start revving models anytime soon. Now that they'll be able to have better supply coming out of multiple factories, that should help bottom line in their sales in this quarter as well. So while I think most of us aren't expecting a rev of the iPad this quarter like was thought earlier in the year, one thing everybody is expecting very, very soon is the iPhone 5, possible iPhone 4S. A lot of rumors still running around this week with respect to those two models. So I thought I'd do a little rumor roundup. AT&T is looking to launch some new prepaid plans, and those could be ripe for something like an iPhone 4S. That is, if you believe the iPhone 4S is even a model, which actually until this weekend I really didn't, although a report came out from Engadget showing a screenshot of supposedly AT&T's internal systems with a listing for a white iPhone 4S. It's expected basically that that's going to be a lower priced model, a very price competitive model for Apple, kind of like the iPhone 3GS is currently, that they'll be able to sell that through carriers at a subsidized price at or close to free. And now it's believed that a lot of these prepaid plans that are coming out from AT&T, Virgin, and Verizon might be ideal plans for a model like the iPhone 4S. AT&T's new prepaid plan is going to have 240 minutes unlimited messaging and will cost $25 a month. I'm assuming there'll be some sort of option to add a data plan on top of that, probably the same kind of Data Plus and Data Pro plans that they have currently on the iPad at $15 and $25 a month additional. A much better deal in terms of prepaid will be, though, the Virgin Mobile plans, which offer 300 minutes and unlimited texting along with unlimited data for $35 US a month. And then Verizon had announced their plans, which are completely unlimited across the board, unlimited voice, text, and data, but will run you a more hefty $50 a month. But I would imagine if you're a heavy data user, want to pick up an iPhone 4S on Verizon and then run the plan, that's a pretty good deal at $50 a month. So no word on whether or not tethering would be included with any of these plans. I believe all the carriers announced that even if they do, they'll at least have data throttling, if not caps, at least for their most high bandwidth customers. So again, unlimited doesn't always end up being unlimited when you start talking about data throttling. Oh, I guess you can still have the unlimited data, but it's going to run a little bit more slowly. I don't know if that's quite ideal for most heavy data users, but at least they don't completely cut you off. Again, all this is pure speculation. At this point, no one knows if iPhone 4S even really exists, and even if it does, if any of the carriers would support it on their pay-as-they-go plans. Historically, they haven't, so we'll have to stay tuned and see. iPhone 4 shipments have slowed, though, coming out of Foxconn, at least according to 9to5Mac. They looked at the August numbers and said Apple is shipping less devices, which is generally an indicator that new models are on the way. So I don't think there's any doubt at this point that we're going to see some new models. It's just a matter of when. A lot of people were also expecting an iPod Touch update, although the 9to5 piece noted that the iPod Touch shipments didn't seem to be slowing down. As far as an iPhone 5 model, we saw a couple more case leaks this week. Casemate supposedly leaked an image of the iPhone 5, or it was thought, because they quickly pulled the images back down, but not before several of the tech blogs picked them up and sort of reposted them. If they are accurate, then the quote-unquote radical new design for the iPhone 5 that everybody's expecting, I personally think, is basically just an iPod Touch, because looking at their case, I could have sworn that it was just the case for the current generation iPod Touch. Basically, what you see is a thinner iPhone 5, slightly wider with the curved back. This kind of matches up with a lot of the other rumors we've been seeing. The back is also aluminum, but not the shiny aluminum that you would see on the iPod Touch, but more of the brushed metal style material like is on the current generation iPad 2. Also, they've done away with kind of the silver round buttons and gone with the more elongated black plastic buttons for the volume controller. So not like a rocker that is on the iPhone 3GS, but separate buttons, just again, like on the iPod Touch. So I don't know if we call that a radical design. People are still saying it's a radical design change, but really it seems like Apple's sort of consolidating the two designs together so that they're similar. And that may make a lot of sense when you consider there have been some rumors that Apple is going to bring out a version of the iPod Touch with 3G support. So you could imagine it kind of being all one model with slightly different innards, but the same form factor. That would be good news actually for case manufacturers as well. So I'm just kind of speculating on that. That's my theory as I saw these designs and them sort of coming together and matching that up with some of the rumors we've been hearing. I have no other evidence beyond my own sort of imagination to back that up. But when you think about it logically, it does tend to make a little bit of sense. Another thing pointing to an update of the iPhone 5s is Apple Care reps were reportedly being told to expect an 8-time increase in iOS-related call volume starting on October 10th. So still seems to be around the first, second week of October when most people are predicting this update. That could be an update to iOS, the iOS 5 update, or the iCloud update, bumping up those AppleCare calls. But it also could mean that we have an iPhone launch pending, although many people are thinking that the iPhone actual launch is going to happen on Friday the 14th. But what could happen is we could hear an announcement and the release of iOS 5 on, say, the 10th, that along with iCloud, and that quickly followed up by the iPhone launch at the end of the week, although some sites have set the release date of the iPhone 5 even earlier at the 7th. I'm tending to start to believe the 14th number just based on the fact that we didn't get an announcement from Apple about any kind of special event. And if you start working the dates backward, I don't think they're going to be ready before the 14th, at least not for shipping new iPhone 5s. Sprint could be getting the iPad 2 in addition to the iPhone 5. It is predicted that Sprint and T-Mobile and basically all the U.S. carriers are going to get the iPhone starting with the iPhone 5. Sprint may also be getting an iPad 2. And if they do, it's rumored that they will be extending their unlimited data plans to both the iPhone and the iPad 2, which could be really good news if you're a heavy data user and could help them win over some customers from AT&T and Verizon. I was kind of with this rumor up until the point where they said that it would be a different model iPad, meaning that we'd have a third model of the iPad being the AT&T model, 3G model, the Verizon CDMA model, and then the new Sprint CDMA model. And that's where it gets weird because both Sprint and Verizon use CDMA networks. So you think that Apple would use the same current generation iPad. There's some speculation that the difference could be because Sprint's iPad 2 model would have support for their 4G WiMAX. But again, the rumor breaks down a little bit for me there because Sprint already announced that they're going to be moving their 4G away from WiMAX to LTE. So I don't think they'd want to include that chipset just for to have a whole separate model. Apple wouldn't want to build a whole separate model just for Sprint when they could, you know, continue with their current generation models, the same ones they sell to Verizon. As far as iPhone 5 demand, it is going to be huge, the highest yet, at least according to RBC analyst Mike Abramsky. He has numbers from a survey conducted with 2,200 people. 31% said that they were likely to buy an iPhone 5. They did a similar survey back when the iPhone 4 was being released, and at that time it showed just 25% of consumers saying they were likely to buy an iPhone 4. So demand for iPhone 5 seems to be even higher than iPhone 4, which if you remember was just crazy. They also note that 66% of current iPhone owners in the survey said that they were likely to upgrade to an iPhone 5. So that means one of every, or two of every three of you who have an iPhone 4 are going to be upgrading. Is that true? Send me feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the news for this week, you know, I don't get that excited about rumors anymore, especially when we keep hearing the same ones over and over again. But Mac Rumors reported on something that I'm actually excited about. They reported that a developer found some source code references to iMessage in the frameworks of OS X Lion's version of iChat. The speculation is that when iOS 5 is released, that iMessage support will be in there. It'll be added into iChat with a software update. And I think this makes a whole lot of sense because it'll help with the adoption of iMessage. It opens up a whole additional user base, Mac users, to the platform. And it also means that the conversations that you're having on your iOS device can follow you from being mobile over to the desktop when you get home. Whether or not it's true or not, Apple does definitely need to do something about their messaging strategy because, in my opinion, it's completely a mess. We've got iChat, which does video, audio, and text. We're going to have iMessage or messages on the phone, which that's your SMS and the new iMessage protocol when iOS 5 comes out. So more ways to send text messages. And then Apple has its FaceTime technology that allows video calling. And they have that both on the desktop and on iOS devices. So you kind of never know when you're messaging with people using Apple technologies, which one you're going to use. Do you do video over iChat or we do video over FaceTime? And it ties into similar accounts as well. So it's also adding to the confusion over the Apple ID and where you do stuff. You know, personally, I'd like to see all of these messaging technologies rolled into one thing. We can just call it iMessage, and it could exist across the entire line from iPhone to iPod to to desktop to iPad, it would just be awesome to have all of that in one place. It really doesn't seem like there's a need to have three different applications because there's so much crossover. I would imagine they could separate the text out from the video so you could have iMessage and iChat kind of together handling the text thing, and then you could move all your video stuff over to FaceTime, so have your video chat, your iChat over there. But I really think that they need to do more of a Skype-style integration where everything's integrated into a single client. You have a single place that you go on your Mac or on your iOS device to handle your messaging. Of course, it's not without its challenges, though, because iChat supports a lot of other protocols. You have AIM in there and Jabber and Google Talk and Yahoo, so they're going to have to sort out how all of that gets resolved. But I think, again, if it all just kind of merges into one specific desktop client, that would be an ideal situation, I think, for the end users and would just help simplify things across the board, which we know Apple is usually really great at, but I think they've really kind of messed up messaging in a big way. And hopefully this is an indication and a sign, early sign, that they're working on resolving that. So on the last episode, I talked a little bit about just my thoughts about what's going on with Apple and the iPad and all of the lawsuits, specifically the ones targeted at Samsung over design of the iPad and Samsung's tablets. And I'm starting to understand and see, when you look at Samsung's designs, how close they are to what Apple's doing and why Apple might be a little bit upset with Samsung and going after them in the courts, you know, blocking them in Germany, blocking them in Australia, and things like that. You know, to a certain degree, I wish that that wasn't going on. I understand why Apple has a need to protect its intellectual property, and with the patent system and the laws and stuff the way they are now, it's sort of what Apple has to do. I just wish that companies could get to competing on their own merits, and, you know, they all borrow from each other to a certain degree, but sort of the blatant copying, I think, is what Apple's really taking issue with. And specifically with Samsung, Tony pointed out in an email to me why Apple may feel a little bit more slighted by Samsung than some of the other companies, because I had pointed out that, you know, Android's borrowed a lot of ideas. There's a bunch of other tablets on the market that have probably borrowed ideas from the iPad. Jeff Gamet had pointed out to me that if you look at the market, both for smartphones and for tablets, prior to Apple putting out the iPhone and the iPad, designs were very different than they are today. And when you look at devices today, most of them look like an iPhone or an iPad, at least to a certain degree. So it does make sense that Apple would think that a lot of people, or feels that a lot of people, are stealing their designs. But in the case of Samsung, as Tony pointed out, Apple has given $8 billion of its business to Samsung. They were a partner with Samsung, and Samsung likely had more access and early access to some of Apple's internal information. So it, in a way, makes their copying seem even more egregious. It's also likely why Apple is moving its contracts away from Samsung as they expire. Big news story came out this week that the next generations of Apple's processors, the A6 and A7, are going to be produced exclusively by Taiwan Semiconductor. So the reason for that is Apple Apple does not take lightly people stealing their ideas, especially when they're close business partners and stuff like that. I think Steve Jobs is pretty well known historically for being very upset with that. And Tony pointed out, you know, it's a similar situation with Google and Eric Schmidt or Andy Rubin. You know, those guys were pretty close with Apple. They had some internal things, and then they turned around and seemed to have borrowed a lot of Apple's ideas. And you have to wonder how much of that is based on some inside information while they got at Apple. You might also make the same argument against John Rubinstein and HP and WebOS. You know, how many of their ideas were borrowed very closely from, or came about very closely from, information that they had while, that Rubinstein had, that he picked up while he was working at Apple, working on Teams and things like that. So it makes sense that Apple would be upset and sort of fighting this out in the courts. As much as I don't like to see that going on, I wish Apple could just make great products and not have to worry about that stuff, but it kind of is the world we live in these days. So thanks, Tony, for sending in your thoughts on that story. Stan sent me an email pointing out a bug that seems to have surfaced in the latest update of Lion, macOS 10.7.1. The update came out, I believe, last week or the week before. And he pointed me to a large discussion, or I guess a growing discussion, on Apple's forums. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But what's happening, and a couple of people have emailed me about this as well, what's happening is after restarting your Mac, the icons on the desktop are suddenly rearranged and ordered cleanly on the right-hand side of your screen, despite however you might have had them arranged on the desktop before. So some people like to have their icons over on the left or in different areas, or you've put certain things in certain places, and that's how you like your desktop. What's in essence happening is you're rebooting, and then suddenly everything's organized on the right-hand side of the screen. And I jokingly said, well, you know, it might be Steve Jobs' way of saying that you need to clean up your desktop. I doubt Steve Jobs likes a messy desktop. But if you like having a messy desktop, you should be able to have it that way. And it always has been that way. So this is a really weird, odd bug. To me, it seems like something's going on that maybe is causing corruption in the desktop's hidden.ds store file. I don't know if you're aware, but on your Mac, there is, in every folder or directory in OS X, there's a file called .ds_store. And the dot makes it a hidden file in the Unix directory structure file system. So that's the dot. But inside that file is all the information for that folder, in this case the desktop, that stores information about where things are positioned, how windows are positioned and sized and stuff like that. So all that information is contained in there. And if that gets corrupt, then it'll reset. And so it turns out that there is kind of a fix if you've run into this bug, and you can use the terminal or some other application that displays invisible files, and you can remove the .ds store file, just delete it, you know, doing an rm command from the terminal or whatever tool you like to use, Pathfinder, who's been a sponsor on the MacCast in the past. If you have a copy of Pathfinder, you can use that to remove hidden files, or there's a bunch of other applications that you can get. And once you remove that, what will happen is the .ds store file will be automatically rebuilt, and then you should be able to put everything back in place, and then it should stick the way you like it. Now, of course, because this is a bug in Lion, there's no guaranteeing that it won't come back, but at this point, what you might want to do after you've restored everything because of that is back up the .ds store file for the desktop. So again, you can use Terminal or any other application that lets you see hidden files and make a copy of that. Because if the .ds store file becomes corrupt again, then you would have to redo this whole procedure and put all your stuff back in place on your desktop. But if you have the backup, you could just restore that backup file. I'm not sure. I don't think there'd be any way to get it from Time Machine. That would be cool, but I don't think with Time Machine that you can view invisible files. So you could restore it. The only weird thing about making the backup is that if you add additional files to your desktop, so if your desktop changes, you're going to have to go back and make another backup before the file gets corrupt again, so that you have the most recent version, most recent copy to restore. I guess you could write a script or something like that to continually back up the .ds store file in that case, or back it up periodically, something like that. But that might be a way to go. You could also write an Automator app, and I was able to do this pretty quickly and easily to back up and restore that file if you want to make the process easier. So you could just throw that in your dock and have a Automator script that backs up the file. So if you change anything on your desktop, just make sure you run that Automator script and that'll do it. Obviously, these are all short-term fixes. Apple is going to have to do something to resolve this issue. I haven't run across this bug, so I don't know if it's specific to specific machines or what have you, but hopefully Apple will address it in a future software update. And sorry, Stan, to hear that you're having trouble with that, but maybe some of these tips will help you out. So in case you haven't noticed, Apple's had a lot of success, business success, in the last few years, pretty much since Steve Jobs returned to Apple and brought out the iMac. There's been a series of great revolutionary products that have helped the company grow and grown the stock. The stock price went up over $400 a share this week. I think it's still there. It hasn't dropped, but likely will go back down. But Regardless, no one could argue the fact that Apple's been hugely successful, especially most recently with the iOS devices, the iPhone and the iPad, and they continue to excel. Well, one aspect of Apple's success, so there's a lot of analysis going on, and I've done a lot of analysis on the show about what's behind Apple's success, and I think it's really their focus on just making truly great products and not worrying so much about things like market share and necessarily what the competition is doing. Apple just kind of focuses on Apple and doing what they do really well, and I think ultimately it's turned out very good. Very good for them. I don't think anybody can argue these facts. But one aspect I hadn't really thought about was something that was brought up by Seth Weintraub over at 9to5 Mac. He wrote a great piece this week on one aspect of Apple's consumer success that I think often goes overlooked. I certainly overlooked it, but is very significant nonetheless. And it was the naming of their products. And this goes to marketing. I think people have looked at Apple's marketing before, but I don't know if anybody's really just sat down and thought about how they name their products and how that might be part of why they're so successful. So I'll have a link to the 9to5 piece in the show notes at maccast.com. But the point was is that Apple's naming compared to other technology companies is, like everything else they do, just simple. Simple words and nothing, really nothing more. You don't get a lot of acronyms or funny model numbers and stuff like that. So you think about things like Mac, iPod, iPhone, iPad, Apple TV. Those are their products. There's no confusing model numbers. The iPhone has a little bit of it. I mean, we had the 3G and the 3GS and the iPhone 4, the iPhone 4S and 5. But I think that just further illustrates the point. Those are really just indicators of new models, but they're not really long, confusing, esoteric figures that nobody knows really what those mean. And Apple's extended this philosophy kind of to their software. We have OS X Lion now. They even kind of, if you look at how Apple writes it out on their marketing and their website, they've kind of dropped the 10.6, 10.5, 10.7. It's OS X Snow Leopard, OS X Lion. You have iLife. Yeah, again, they have the numbers on there, iLife 11, but most people just refer to them as iLife. And if you look at the titles in the App Store of the specific applications in the iLife 11 suite, it's just iPhoto, iMovie, GarageBand. And so Apple just really sticks to the simple naming. And this change did seem to happen around the time that Steve Jobs returned to Apple. If you remember the Performa naming, remember the Performa models? There were like dozens of different models with these cryptic model numbers. I had a Performa 575, but there were all these little variants, and it was sort of like every little variant had a slight tweak to the hardware configuration, and that's why it had a different model number. But that just led to this bloated kind of product line in terms of the number of different models, and the supply chain was all messed up, and you know, Tim Cook was brought in to come clean that stuff up. But it wasn't just even the Performa models. Remember the Power Macintoshes? There was the 6100, the 7100, the 8100, and just within the 7100 line, there was also a 7200, a 7215, a 7220, 7300, 7500, 7600. You know, they were all released one after the other, and they were different upgrades and models. But, I mean, who could figure this stuff out? And they didn't even go sequentially. The 7220 came after the 7600. So, you know, it's like Apple's competitors use numbers in much the same way. If you look at the different models of smartphones and things like that, they have these cryptic codes that kind of define the new model numbers or slight variations within the specifications in a given line, and they usually don't go in any kind of rational order or sequence, and definitely don't help the customer or the consumer make a buying decision. You have to kind of know ahead of time, and you got to do all this research to figure out which one's better, which one has the better specs, because sometimes the one with the lower model number is the higher-end device or higher-end product. And I mean, how is anybody supposed to know that? You have to know the specs behind the code to go make a buying decision, and that's just crazy and certainly not the Apple way. So if you look after Steve Jobs returns to Apple, he goes through and he kind of slashes everything out. He just whittles it down to the bare necessities and then gives all of the models kind of specific names that really indicate who they're targeted at and who they're for. So we end up with the Power Mac and the iMac and the PowerBook and the iBook. And then the same thing happens with the iPods. You get the iPod Shuffle, iPod Nano, iPod Touch. And the philosophy extended even beyond the core products and into their peripherals and accessories too. So with the AirPorts, right, you have the AirPort Extreme, and the AirPort Express. And it's really clear what that transition is. The AirPort was the original base station. So if you needed a Wi-Fi base station from Apple, you bought the AirPort. Well, when they came out with an improved model, it was the Extreme. Right? AirPort Extreme. Oh, and if you want the smaller portable one, well, that's the Express, right? Makes sense. It's not complicated. And you just know which one is appropriate. Same thing when you're looking at the Mac model. So if you were a pro user, you got the Power Mac. The home user, the iMac. If you wanted a portable, well, it was a PowerBook for the pro user and an iBook for the home user. Same thing on the peripherals. Again, they have the Magic Mouse and the Magic Trackpad. One mouse, one trackpad, that's it. You don't have to worry about specs. You just buy what you want. It's not confusing for the consumer. And Apple doesn't really change the names as the products mature. So in a lot of ways, it's like people. You're given a name when you're born, right? And no matter how you age or how much you improve or get better, that's still the thing. So if you need a consumer-level Mac from Apple, you're going to buy a desktop system, you're going to buy an iMac. Maybe a Mac Mini, right? But Mac Mini, smaller version, easier, smaller price, entry-level. Again, it makes sense. The naming not only simplifies the choices, but the other benefit it has from a marketing standpoint is it also humanizes and personalizes the products to a certain degree. So Seth pointed out in his piece that when you listen to Steve Jobs in a keynote, he refers to the products as iPod or iMac, not the iPod or the iMac. And if you really stop to think about it, well, then that's the thing that kind of personalizes it. It makes it almost feel like a member of the family, right? And I even know Apple users who name their devices. They name their computers or their iPhones or iPods just like they would a pet. And I don't really see that. I don't know that many people who have nicknamed their PC. Maybe occasionally, but I find it more common in Apple users. And I think it goes to some of this naming and stuff like that. So Apple simplifies the entire buying experience, not just the products you buy. So when you walk into an Apple store or a retailer, they can really quickly ask you a few questions and point you to the right device. Are you a pro or are you consumer? Do you need a portable or a desktop? Do you want good, better, or best? You know, if you've gone on Apple's website to do the buying, remember when they did the good, better, best thing? I don't think they have those acronyms anymore, but it still kind of stands. When you go there, you get the columns, right? You go to the Apple store to buy a computer. It says, here's the base configuration. Here's the middle tier. Here's the upper tier. Pick which one you want. And then there aren't a lot of variations in terms of specs and stuff like that. Just minor, subtle differences. And you buy based on your needs, not the specs. And in some ways, competitors to Apple, I think, would point this out as a disadvantage, that Apple is, quote-unquote, limiting consumer choice. But I think what we're seeing now, especially with consumer buying habits, is that most consumers are overwhelmed by choice. They can't figure it out. And then you throw on top of it some, you know, cryptographic product name, and they don't even know necessarily what they're buying. Most consumers just can't figure this stuff out. And it's not because they're not intelligent or smart. It's just how can anybody, unless you're going bullet point by bullet point, when you have, you know, a model line of digital camera, say, and there are 37 different models with the same name and then some little weird model number after it. I had this exact problem buying a digital camera or video camera. It takes me days to decipher the specs, and I still often feel when I'm walking out of the store that maybe I made the wrong choice. So Apple stores and Apple products are just simplified. The stores themselves are laid out in a clean, bright, organized way. It's thought out. You walk in, depending on what you want to buy, you go to a specific area, and there it is for you. And if you want to see a great example of this simplification, Apple this week, or over the last week, I think, simplified their online buying experience for the iPad. And it's distilled down to the simple basic choices. And this is another reason, I think, for the success of the iPad, is consumers don't have to worry about a bunch of specs. You go in, and on the online site, it's a single page. Starts out, do you want white or black, right? Do you want Wi-Fi or 3G is the second question. Third question, 16, 32, or 64 gigabytes. Done. That's it. And I'm fudging a little bit, of course, because on the 3G models, you have to pick a carrier. Do you want Verizon or AT&T? But let's just say you go Wi-Fi. Those are all the choices you have to make. Otherwise, all the specs are exactly the same. You have the same processor, the same amount of RAM, the same screen sizes, everything. And I think that's why consumers are so taken with the iPad and why they love it so much, is it's just simplified across the board. Software installation is simplified. Application installation is simplified. Restoring is simplified. It's distilled down, and you don't have to think about it. You don't have to worry about it. You turn it on and you use it. Same thing when you're buying it. You just decide, how much storage do I want? Do I want Wi-Fi or 3G? Do I want white or black? And then I have the device that I want, and you use it and you love it. And I think it goes a long way to Apple's success. So I just thought it was a great piece by Seth. You know, it's one other instance where Apple has kind of thought out the whole experience and the whole thing from beginning to end, including the marketing, including the buying experience, including just the naming of the products. So I thought that was pretty cool, and I just wanted to share that with you. So it happens every couple months or so that I'll get a question from somebody about formatting an external hard drive to use cross-platform. Somebody who wants to have one drive that they can take between a Mac and a Windows machine, maybe possibly a Linux machine, but most commonly it's usually a Mac and a PC. And it all comes down to usually the PC supporting NTFS. They want to use NTFS formatting versus the FAT32. So I don't know if you know or not. I'm sure we've talked about it on the show in the past. But if you use FAT32 to, say, format a USB thumb drive or a USB external drive, you can do it using Disk Utility. And the Mac can read and write to a FAT32 volume. If you use NTFS, which I believe is still the default formatting on Windows, it has been for a long, long time, you can read NTFS formatted disks on a Mac with OS X, but you cannot write to an NTFS formatted disk. So I got the question this week, how can I do a read-write to an NTFS formatted drive? And there's actually some ways to do this, but I guess under Lion, some of the ways that used to work are either not working or turning out to be a little bit flaky. So usually when this comes up, my recommendation is, well, just use FAT32. But FAT32 has a 4 gigabyte size limit. So if you have a USB key above 4 gigs that you need to format, or if you have a larger external drive, you either have to do some partitioning, or you can only have 4 gigabyte chunks, which isn't really all that ideal in this day and age with file sizes the way they are and stuff like that, especially if you need to move large files like video and stuff back and forth. There are actually a couple commercial products out there right now that can read and write NTFS on the Mac and are supported under Lion, are Lion compatible. One is called Textera NTFS for Mac. I believe it's $34.20. You can find that at Textera.com, T-U-X-E-R-A.com. And there's also one called Paragon NTFS for Mac. And that one's $19.99 US, and that's at Paragon Software, Paragon-software.com. And so those are commercial solutions, but a lot of people like the free solutions or would like a free solution. And so on the free side, the thing that always used to work was something called Fuse. And Fuse is an open source project. It stands for File System in User Space. And basically what it does is it allows you on a Linux system or a Unix system to create a file system on the fly in the user space, and then it provides a bridge between that file system and the kernel interface, the built-in interface for your operating system. And there was a Mac version of the Fuse project, called Mac Fuse. And it was a Google project. It's an OS X port of the Fuse open source project. And it was developed for Leopard and ran in 32-bit. And it actually ran fine under Snow Leopard, but I guess it's not working all that well under Lion from what I was able to garner from the research that I was able to do. Tuxtera, the company that makes that commercial product I just mentioned, actually has created a Mac Fuse port that is compatible with Lion called Fuse 2.2. And there's also a new branch of the Mac Fuse port called OS X Fuse. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. And so that covers the file system and user space portion running in Lion, so you can check out those projects. But once you have that, then you need to have something to actually create the file system you want to work with. So in this case, we're talking about NTFS. There's lots of other file systems out there and lots of other things that are supported by Mac Fuse. I happen to use it to do SFTP, and you can also use it for SSH kind of file browsing and stuff like that. It's actually a pretty cool project if you want to check it out. But Tuxtera had also made a Fuse-supported file system, NTF file system for the Mac called NTFS 3G. And it worked in version 10.4 through 10.6. So that's how a lot of people were getting NTFS support on the Mac, read-write support on the Mac for free. They were using Mac Fuse along with the NTFS 3G. I don't know if you call them extensions or add-ons or whatever, but the NTFS 3G from Tuxtera. And I guess now it does sort of work in Lion. You get errors, but even using Tuxtera's own Mac Fuse 2.2 and the NTFS 3G, which are both from them, I was reading that you get these mounting errors, and it does take a while, like 15 seconds to mount your drive. It does seem to work, I guess, read-write fine once it's mounted, although the one article I was able to find referencing this kind of said they'd only done light testing on it, so they weren't 100% sure that it was going to be completely compatible or completely working. So what are your options if you're running Lion and you need free NTFS support, or you want to have an external drive that is cross-platform? Well, your first option is, one, don't upgrade. You know, stay on Snow Leopard, and then you'll have NTFS support through Mac Fuse. The other option would be to buy get Mac Fuse 2.2 and the NTFS 3G from Tuxtera, but again, it does seem a little bit dodgy, so may or may not work, may or may not be something that you want to trust. Or buy a commercial product. The pricing to me seems very reasonable. And if you absolutely need NTFS read-write support on the Mac, I would say that's the way to go. So get the Paragon product or the Tuxtera product. Now, that's if you absolutely think that you need to stick with NTFS, right? There is a new option that is fully cross-platform, read-write on the Mac, works with Windows, doesn't really work, as far as I know, on Linux. So if you need, you know, triple cross-platform, Windows, Mac, and Linux, this might not work for you. But there's a new version of FAT that is supported by 10.6, 10.7. It was actually introduced as part of the 10.6.5 update on the Mac, also supported in Windows, and it's called XFAT. It's supported in Windows XP Service Pack 2 with an update, Vista Service Pack 1, and Windows 7. I'm assuming also in Windows 8. To use it, if you have existing drives, you're going to have to back up your existing NTFS formatted drives, completely reformat in the XFAT format, and then restore that data. So just be aware of that. It's not going to be a simple transition if you're already trying to use NTFS. But you can do that, and you can format drives in the XFAT format using Disk Utility. And it gets past the limitations of FAT32. I think it pretty much supports drives of up to any size. So you can check that out. And I would say that's the way to go if you need true external drive, cross-platform read-write support, and you need to be able to use large drives. So that should give you some ideas and some options for doing this stuff. I have to give credit. A lot of the research that I found for this piece came from a great article by Neil Turner over on his blog. If you want to read more about it and get more details, more of the technical ins and outs, you can go check that out. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It's at neilturner.me.uk, neilturner.me.uk. All right, let's finish up with a cool little tip or a couple cool little tips for mission control in OS X Lion. You know, I haven't really been using mission control all that much, I have to be honest, but I definitely use the multiple desktops and am enjoying that. And it's funny because I never really used Spaces in OS X Snow Leopard. I know a lot of people who really liked Spaces a lot. I think I'm using the desktops mainly because I like full screen mode for a couple applications, specifically my RSS newsreader, my mail, and Safari. And it works well for me because I just have the MacBook Pro, so I only have a single screen. And so it helps kind of organize things and work out my spaces. But one of the features that existed in Spaces in Snow Leopard was the ability to launch specific applications into a specific space. So a lot of people set up spaces based on different kinds of applications. So you might have all of your communication apps in one place. So you might have mail and your Twitter client and your chat client, iChat or AIM or something like that, all in one space. Or you might have your productivity applications in one space and your design applications in another space, things like that. And so maybe you want to have those applications always open up to a specific desktop in Lion. And the way it used to work under Spaces in Snow Leopard is you would set all of that stuff in the Spaces system preference pane. Well, in Lion, it's a little bit different because you use mission control and desktops, and the assignment is actually performed from the dock and within that desktop. So what happens is you want to launch the application and then you want to go into mission control. And I only know the shortcut from my Magic Mouse. So it's a 2-finger tap on the Magic Mouse. I think it's a 3-finger swipe up. Yeah, 3-finger swipe up on the trackpad if you're a trackpad user, or you can just, you know, use the Mission Control application to launch into it. And then once you're inside Mission Control, then you want to drag your application. If you don't have the desktop already set up for it, you want to drag your application from the Mission Control window up to the upper right-hand corner of your screen, up in that area, and you'll see a little plus icon kind of slide out. Drop the application on there, and that will load it onto another desktop. And then you can go to that desktop and then control-click or right-click on the application icon in the dock, and then you'll see an options area or item. Select that, and then under that, you'll see three choices under assign to. And now you can assign that to the desktop in a couple different ways, or a specific desktop in a couple different ways. You need to have multiple desktops active in Mission Control before you'll see the assign to option, so just be aware of that. But once it's there, you'll have all desktops, which means that that application will now appear on every desktop that you navigate to. This desktop, which is the one we're looking for in this case, which means that this application will always launch to whatever desktop it is currently on when you set this option. So if you're on desktop 3 and now you've quit the application, you're back on desktop 1, you launch the application again, it's going to launch onto desktop 3 and be there. And then the last option is none, which is the default, which means the application will launch to whatever desktop that you're currently in. One thing to note about this is if you assign a desktop or an application, excuse me, to a specific desktop, and then you remove that desktop from Mission Control. And the way you do that is you go into Mission Control, you hold down the Option key, and you'll get the little close button by all your different desktops. If you close that desktop, basically destroying it, and then you go back and try and launch that app again, it's going to go back to the default, to the none. So it'll launch onto whatever desktop that you're currently on, because the desktop that it was originally assigned to no longer exists. So if you've set this up and you have multiple desktops, you can't destroy those desktops. Otherwise, you'll break the linkage for this feature. And I don't remember it being that way in Spaces, but again, I didn't use Spaces all that much in Snow Leopard. But that's how you do it under Mission Control in Lion. And then the other cool feature that you can do now with Mission Control was something that a lot of people really requested and asked for, and that was the ability to assign different desktop backgrounds to different desktops. And once again, in Mission Control, everything seems to be contextually, I'm going to call it contextually related, or related to setting things up when you're on a specific desktop. So you really have to think about those desktops as almost different environments with their own settings and things like that. So to set a different desktop background, all you do is you go into Mission Control, you go to the specific desktop you want to assign the desktop background for, and then once you're in that desktop, in that space, then you launch System Preferences from there, and then go into the Desktops and Screensavers, set your desktop background, and then it will stick to the specific desktop that you're in. So now you'll have different backgrounds for your different desktops, and that's how you do it. And I don't think that's really made that clear when Apple launched Lion. You know, it seems like it'd be better if you could just do it the old way, like you could with Spaces, and just somehow set it within the Spaces System Preferences. But under Mission Control, you, in essence, just think of each desktop as kind of its own environment or its own instance of the operating system with its own settings and stuff like that. And I think that ends up being a little bit clearer way to think about it. But a couple cool tricks that you can do with Mission Control. And with that, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors for the month. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. Check out version 5, just recently released with Lion compatibility. You can find more information and details over at Phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook. Get free trials, more information, and details over at CircusPonies.com. Smile, Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, they make a ton of great products. You can get information on all of them, as well as check out demos and more information over at SmileSoftware.com. And Gazelle, you know what? If you're getting ready to buy an iPhone 5 and you want to get cash for that old iPhone 4, you might want to go look at Gazelle right now, because as it gets closer and more hit the market, the pricing is going to go down. But they'll give you cash for your old electronics. You just do a simple search. They'll give you an upfront offer. Take it or leave it. And you can find more information and details over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I'm getting a lot of great feedback on the Why Am I an Apple User segment. So please continue to send your stories about why you're an Apple user. I look forward to getting those. You can just attach an audio file to your email. Almost any format will work. MP3, AAC, AIFF, anything that you can do. GarageBand is great for recording those, or just use the built-in audio recorder in QuickTime 10. It's an awesome way to do it, or even easier, use the built-in recorder on your iPhone, your iPod Touch. Attach those to an email, send it to maccast@gmail.com, and I look forward to receiving those. You can also just send in your general questions and comments and stuff like that. You can also call in on the listener hotline. The number for that is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, and leave your voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And be sure to check out the MacCast.com website. There you will find show notes and links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.